Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it seemed like a good idea at the time. President Obama wanted to speak directly to school children to encourage them to work hard and stay in school. An internet speech was scheduled for next Tuesday, and schools were alerted weeks ago they had the option to run it. But this week, the news exploded on right-wing websites and talk shows. On Rush Limbaugh, the president was compared to Saddam Hussein and Kim Jong-il of North Korea, guests and callers accusing the president of trying to indoctrinate students. In Texas and other states, parents are threatening to pull their kids out of school next Tuesday, and school officials across the country are scrambling to figure out what to do. Todd Gilman is Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Todd, what are parents in Texas saying?
Well, many of them are thrilled to have the president come into the classrooms, but many others are not so thrilled. There have been hundreds and hundreds of complaints lodged with local school districts, and a lot of the school districts have responded by saying, well, we're just not going to show this. We're not going to take class time to do this, but we'll make the speech available so that kids can see it after school hours or on their own time.
We understand in Wiley, Texas, for instance, school officials are going to tape the speech and then allow some teachers to show it or kids to see it if they want to. But what is the concern? What do they feel is going to be said? What is the harm?
I think part of the concern going in was that nobody knew for sure exactly what the president was planning on saying. Chances were, and the White House says explicitly, that all the president wants to do is give a message that kids, you need to stay in school, you need to pay attention, you need to follow directions and study hard, and that's how you'll get ahead in life. But nobody knew exactly what he was going to say. The White House now says, as of yesterday, that they will release the text of the speech a day ahead of time just so that everybody can see it.
Did the Education Department maybe give conservatives ammunition by suggesting that teachers incorporate parts of the speech into the curriculum or react to the speech afterwards in the classroom?
Right. And that was a big red flag, particularly in a place like Texas, where people really value local control over education. The Washington should be hands-off when it comes to curriculum, particularly the way some of these suggested study guides were worded. You kids should write an essay on what you can do to help the president. Write down something that inspired you about the president. The context of it was clearly, what can you do to help the president in the specific goals that he has laid out in terms of improving schools and keeping kids in schools and reducing the dropout rate. But it seemed very cult of personality to people who are not inclined to buy into the Obama worldview. The language was inartful, as the White House has now acknowledged. Mm. That's one of the things that the White House was forced to rewrite and tell the Education Department to revise that language. So instead of how can you help the president, it's now how can you help yourself achieve academic goals.
Well, has the White House made it clear that, for instance, the president won't be talking about health care reform or anything on his agenda?
They have now made that clear. In the face of this firestorm this week, they have made that clear. That was not made clear ahead of time, possibly because the White House just misread it and assumed that everybody would understand that a president talking to school kids was a fairly innocuous use of the bully pulpit. But the White House left itself open to this kind of attack by not being clear and allowed conservative critics to accuse the White House of trying to bypass parents, trying to bypass educators. Here's the president beaming straight into your kid's classroom without the intermediation that a parent might want to have.
Something, by the way, the first President Bush did back in 1991. He also made a speech to kids encouraging them to stay in school. But we mentioned health care reform. The president will be speaking about that Wednesday. You write that you feel that the health care debate has factored into this as a part of this.
Yes, I think that politics clearly is the subtext of the attacks on the president. Here's a president who had a terrible, terrible summer on the biggest domestic agenda item that he's got going, health care. He's giving a big, kind of a Hail Mary pass speech to Congress a day after the school speech. Well, his critics look at this as an opening. He's a little weak. Let's pounce.
Todd Gilman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Is there any sense that the White House might cancel this scheduled Tuesday internet speech to kids in school? Again, it's optional for schools to pick it up. Because of the thinking that, you know, if some kids are pulled out and others aren't, that this sort of brings this horribly divisive national conversation that's going on, you know, between their parents into the classroom.
I can't imagine that the White House would cancel this speech at this point. They have way too much at stake. They have too much to lose were they to pull out. It would just be too much of a humiliation and embarrassment, and it would be an acknowledgement that all you have to do is challenge the president and he'll back down. That won't happen.
Todd Gilman, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
So schools are back in session, and today we want to have a Friday conversation about what they call Friday night football in many towns. Tonight at Smith Center High School in Smith Center, Kansas, that means the football players will take the field two by two holding hands, as they have for 30 years. After the game, they'll circle up with family and friends to give thanks. At center will be Coach Roger Barta, who sprinkles the words love and respect liberally through his pep talks.
Coaches talk a good game, especially in the college ranks, where they have to persuade mama and daddy to send junior to their programs. High school coaches, on the other hand, tend to come in three varieties. They are either slick rah-rah sorts, profane hard guys, or overwhelmed in learning on the job. Coach Barta was none of the above. What we do around here real well is raise kids, he explained. Then he crossed his arms and propped them upon his stomach and distanced the game of football from what he believed was his true mission in life. None of this is really about football, he said. We're going to get scored on eventually and lose a game, and that doesn't mean anything. What I hope we're doing is sending kids into life who know that every day means something.
That's New York Times sports writer Joe Drabe on Smith Center's Coach Barta, whose approach seems to work. His team takes a 67-game winning streak, the longest in the country, into tonight's season opener. The Redmen have also won five straight state championships. They are so dominant, they scored 72 points in the first quarter of a game 2 years back. Coach Barta was accused of running up that score, even though he pulled his starters and tried desperately to get officials to run the clock out. Well, Joe Drape went to Smith Center to report on that story and was so impressed, he moved his family, wife Mary and young son Jack, from Manhattan to Smith Center to write a book about the town and the team that sustain each other. The result is the terrific Our Boys, a perfect season on the plains with the Smith Center Redmen. And Joe Drake joins us from the studios of KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri, with more. Joe, this is football, but we usually talk to you about horse racing.
Yes, we got live people this time, Robin. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure because the book was such a pleasure. And Smith Center, Kansas, might seem like a throwback to a lot of people. But it will resonate with people who've grown up in small rural towns, don't you think?
Yeah, Robin. I mean, what brought me there was I'm a son of the Midwest. I'm from Kansas City. And I had been away a long time. And on my first visit there, I felt like I was home. And it was really at a time in my life that I wanted to feel that again. I had a young son, a three-year-old, and I wanted to be the parent that my dad was. And, you know, in Manhattan, New York, where I live, It's hard to do that.
Well, you said, in fact, your little boy, when he was like three or something, visited an uncle who had a backyard and said to you, look, Daddy, Uncle Tom, I think it was, has a park.
Exactly. And he had never seen a grasshopper. He had never been to a practice field. And, you know, my wife is from Chicago, and both of us, we wanted more. We wanted that life that we had where you left in the morning and you came home at dark.
Well, and explain the life in Smith Center, Kansas. You paint these pictures of kids working on the family combine, raising hogs. One former player drives you around and talks about he and his friends driving downtown and pulling out couches and plugging in a TV and sitting on a warm night, you know, playing video games while their parents and relatives would come by and say hi to them. Tell us more about this town.
You know, Smith Center is 90 miles away from a McDonald's or a Walmart. Any of the traditional distractions young people have. It's about 1,900 people, and everybody knows everybody. It's truly a place where, you know, the village raise all the children. So you got to make your own fun. And they do. They pull a couch out, get their Xboxes out, and play games. And, you know, everybody knows where the kids are pretty much 24 hours a day. If they're not at school, they're in the weight room working out. Now, and the girls, too. I mean, you know, volleyball is very important. Just keeping an eye on your kids is very important. So, you know, this is a town that's been very dedicated to its children, and it's gone on for generations.
Well, and, you know, some might say, wow, it sounds great, but at one point, Do they keep too close an eye on the kids? The school principal tells you that he feels no compunction about calling up principals of other schools to ask about dates for the school prom. In other words, if somebody from Smith Center was bringing someone from another school, he had no problem with calling up the principal and saying, is this a good kid? Because if it's not, I'm not going to let them in.
Well, you know, the people of Western and Northwestern Kansas take their responsibilities very serious. And yes, Principal Greg Kelch does call and check on dates from kids from out of town. And it's a very delicate ecosystem there. And if you're going to have people come in from outside, you want to know something about them. I mean, here's probably the best way to explain the attitude of parenting in Smith Center, Kansas. Is on Halloween, Gavin Overmiller, a young fifth grader, head water boy, had really taken a liking to my son Jack, and we wanted him to go trick-or-treating with us. So I called Jay Overmiller, who's in the book, who's a farmer, who showed us all about wheat farming. And I said, you know, Jay, can Gavin come trick-or-treating with us? And he goes, of course he can, because I know you treat him like your own. That is the mentality that pervades there.
Well, and now Coach Barta, you say he looks like Wilford Brimley. Right there, you've got me. Tell me just more about him. We heard how he feels that this isn't as much about football as about raising kids, but he's on this winning streak. It's got to be about football, too.
Well, and Coach Barta was really the big lure for me down there. You know, I've been around a lot of different coaches, but here was a guy who doesn't raise his voice. And his philosophy is very simple. It's like, guys, life is about getting a little bit better each day. And, you know, we all do mundane things in life. And the difference between being a success and being just someone else is that you do these little things well. And, you know, he demystifies the whole secrets of success. He basically is telling these guys, you know, the things you and I and everyone wants to know and need. It's make a good impression, listen, treat people with respect. Football is all about what goes on in his locker room. He's not worried about the other team and the other players. You know, I think you could distill Coach Barta's philosophy down to the beginning of the season speech he gave. He said, you know, guys, somebody in here is the best football player and somebody here is the worst. And that's a fact of life. And life's not fair and you're going to deal with this situation all through. But what we all can do is respect each other. And when you respect each other, you learn to like each other. And when you like each other, you learn to love each other. And that's when together you become champions. So, you know, essentially I watched him build an unconfident bunch of seniors. You know, they were talented kids. They had good character, but they didn't believe in themselves. And they didn't believe in each other. And I watched him take this group of boys and really turn them into young men who, you know, would lay down for each other. And it really was a remarkable thing to witness.
Joe Drabe writes about what he witnessed in Our Boys, a perfect season on the plains with the Smith Center Redmen, that's in Kansas there, where football happens off the field as well. All the Smith Center football players appear on bubblegum trading cards and pledge to be alcohol, drug, and tobacco free. And if they break that pledge, they have to go before the elementary school kids who idolize them and explain why they were kicked off the team and off the coveted trading cards. 70% of boys in the Smith Center High are in the football program. When we return, we'll speak with one of the players on last year's team. No one thought they could win. They were state champs. How did the coach do it? Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with sports writer Joe Drabe. His book is Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains with the Smith Center Redmen. It tells the story of Coach Roger Barta and last year's Smith Center High School Kansas football team and their journey to a fifth straight state championship. And now we want to bring in one of the players from that team, Marshall McCall. He was a team captain. Now he's playing football at Hutchinson Junior College in Kansas. And Marshall, from the book, we know a lot about you. We know you had a summer job as a gravedigger. We know you had a bad virus. You were sick when practice started. And we also know there was this sense around town that your senior class might not be as good as the 12 seniors who came before you and left. People doubted that you guys could keep that winning streak alive and win a championship as they had. How did you feel going into that season?
I felt like the Atlas of high school football, carrying the world on my shoulders and the stress that we all had to deal with. And, you know, were we going to lose? Are we going to win another championship? But going into the season, I mean, we were all just kind of a mess. We had confidence problems, and we just really didn't know how to play together yet.
Well, how did it turn around? Because you were instrumental in this. You know, what made it change from 11 new kids, juniors and sophomores, who were scared to death of letting the town down, to the team that didn't seem to care as much about winning as what? I mean, what happened?
We felt more comfortable around each other in school. We started talking to each other about, you know, we had to get better. The way that we were progressing was not going to get the job done. We started bringing the problems out of the darkness and discussing them amongst the team. Thursday nights at the Shed, you know, we actually had more people coming, more people staying.
This is the clubhouse that a lot of the town fathers helped you build. The previous seniors had a clubhouse, and you guys had one too, but you'd all go there, and yet it didn't click at first.
No. You know, the same group of people would go there and hang out, but then there'd be a group over here, a group over here, a little group here, and they'd come and go as they please. But, you know, progressing through the season, we started to get, you know, a group here, and then at the end, there was just the whole team was there.
One group.
The whole team was, yeah, intermingling with everybody because everybody felt comfortable around this person who they might not have before, and everybody just kind of became a team, a family,
per se. And let me ask you about that, because I mentioned Coach Barta. He seemed to talk about love more than, you know, running drills. He seemed to talk about respect for each other more than passing plays. How'd that hit you?
He showed that football can teach you to trust each other. It'll make best friends. It'll teach you a lot about yourself. And just going through that experience with Coach Barta and all those years, he just keeps teaching you and trying to show you how to live instead of teaching you how to play football.
At one point, as part of that, a lot of the players, you'd already given up alcohol, tobacco, and at one point gave up your girlfriends?
Maybe not give up, but I kind of made her realize that football was going to kind of take over my life here in the next month or two, and that I was just going to have to care more about the team and my friends than her. And, you know, she took it pretty well. She realized that football is going to be a big thing for me because it had been stressing me out and it had been stressing the whole team out. So we all just kind of took a vow to get with each other and really grow a friendship, grow some trust.
Marshall, just tell us briefly, what kind of game is it? It's not a passing game. For football aficionados, what is the Redmond game?
100% run, 100% of the time. It's just running right down people's throats, and Coach Bart has been doing it for 37 years, and it seems to be paying off.
Mm-hmm. Joe Drape, I want to bring you back in. Some people might say, geez, this is sounding awfully severe. You know, these kids, you know, hand-wringing over whether or not they're going to be the ones to break the streak. And we haven't even mentioned Marshall suffered a concussion in the first game of the season, you know, kind of a stomach-turning moment. You know, there's always the question about, is there too much focus on sports in schools? Is there too much asked of kids? What's your sense of what it did for them?
It's very interesting in Smith Center that the same people who are at the football games on Friday night or at the junior high girls volleyball games on Thursday afternoon are at the school plays, which all these guys participate in. And, you know, these guys took the weight of the world on it and really didn't need it. You know, they didn't want to let the town down. And the fact of the matter is they've never let the town down. And when that streak is finally broken, it's going to be the town's finest moment because they won't be let down at all. They'll be the first ones down on the field and circle up, and they're the first ones giving their hugs. And, you know, I got to say something about Marshall, Robin. I mean, Marshall's a modest kid, but he was valedictorian. He plays the piano. He sang in the choir. I mean, before the biggest game of the year, 11 of them went down to Osborne down the road and sang in the music festival and mispractice altogether. You know, that's the thing that struck me. I mean, nobody really cares if they win or lose. I mean, sure, they want to win, and they've won a bunch of games. But, you know, nobody says Marshall McCall this, Colt Rogers that. There are boys, and none's more than important than the other.
Smith Center, the kind of town where the fathers would hang on the fence and watch their kids do the same drills with the same coach that they'd done 30 years before. Just a great scene. That's Joe Drape. He tells the story of last year's Smith Center team in his new book, Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains with the Smith Center Redmen. Marshall McCall played on that Smith Center High School football team. He's now a freshman on the Hutchinson Junior College football team. Marshall, just a question. Are you going to be one of the former players that, as Coach Barter says, you know, they grow up and they go away and they do wonderful things away? Or are you going to be one that wants to come back and have your kids play on that team? Do you know yet?
Yes. I know that I'll probably go away for a little bit, you know, go to college, get a job somewhere else. But eventually I want to move back to Smith Center. All my family live there. I want to be a part of that town because, you know, the town was a part of me. So I want to give back and just be able to be where I was the most happy I've ever been.
Well, I want to thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks for having me.
And again, the Smith Center Redmen open their season tonight looking for their 68th straight win. Back after the latest news here and now. The state of Massachusetts collected 36% more in car sales taxes last month, in part due to the Cash for Clunkers program. The Arizona Republic reports that because the average new car transaction there generates about $2,000 in local sales tax revenue, the program also generated millions of dollars for cash-strapped Arizona schools and communities. Well, it turns out junkyards are also benefiting. Junkyards are the end of the line for clunkers, which rip the cars apart and sell them off, except for the engine, which is part of the deal, is destroyed. Al Shanefelt works at Broken Wheel Auto Parts and Wrecking in Cleveland, Ohio. Al, first of all, how are you feeling about the Cash for Clunkers program?
Well, it's good for us. It's a good program. It's had a lot of bumps along the road, but they're working them out slowly but surely. And just in the last, this past week, we've been finally receiving the cars with the proper paperwork.
About how many?
This week so far, I believe we're at 45.
We understand you say bumps along the road. The federal government paid out to less than a quarter of the dealers across the country so far, and the government says they hope to pay them all by the end of the month. So are you getting the cars as the dealers are paid?
Yes, that's how it's been working, because when they get paid, they get the title, then we get a copy of the title, then we can remove the car from their facility.
And, right.
But we cannot until that time has come.
So 45 cars in a week, what does that do? How does that compare to your average?
We're definitely putting some long hours, and we've had to hire a few people to help handle it.
So some jobs have been brought on by the program?
Oh, here, yes, and definitely the towing industry, because we've had to hire towing companies to handle the large volume of cars. So for us here, it's been great, and it's been kind of hectic because we were hoping it was going to be a few a day.
Right.
But for 5 weeks, the paperwork was in turmoil, and now that the paperwork is finally resolved, now we're trying to play catch-up.
Right. And we understand, you work closely with car dealers, and car dealers have been screaming to get these cars off the lots to you.
Exactly.
So what do you do once you get one?
Well, the first thing you have to do is the reason why we got in the program was because we belong to Elvis, End of Life Vehicle Solutions. You had to be a member, and that meant you removed the Freon from the cars, its fluids, its mercury switches. You've had to do that for years to be a part of this.
I laugh, you know, Elvis, end-of-life solutions, but it's very important because this becomes an ecological issue.
Exactly. So we have to, as soon as those cars arrive, remove the Freon, antifreeze, fluids, and the batteries, gasoline, that kind of stuff. So it's a lot of time just to prepare a car to dismantle it.
What do you do with all of that toxic material?
Well, the Freon goes to the Freon companies who actually filter it and make new Freon out of it. Your antifreeze is recycled, filtered, and back into the system. Same with your waste oil.
Huh. Do you sell the tires?
Yes.
Are there parts you can sell?
In this day and age, I've been here almost 30 years. We sell more used tires in the last 2 years than I ever remember. the tires are probably the first thing we sell to the people who can't afford new tires off the cars.
Yeah. And what about that part that gets just flattened, the part that's left, and we understand gets put on trailers and taken to maybe metal recyclers?
Yeah,
or
they have to go to a shredder, and then they're ripped in tiny little pieces.
Yeah. Well, and we remind people this is being done to these cars because we don't want them back on the road because their mileage isn't that great. Is it hard for you, though? I mean, many of these cars were, you know, they ran perfectly well.
Yeah. There's a lot of them that are that you wonder, like, wow, how did this car make the program? A lot of them are nice, but there's a whole bunch of them that are strictly that's where they need to belong.
Right.
So we crush them immediately.
Right. So how overall would you say Cash for Clunkers has gone?
To me personally, I think it was a major hit, obviously because people came out in droves to buy new cars. And I think the program was unprepared for the large volume. That's what it seemed to me.
Yeah. Well, we're reading, the Boston Globe has reported on this, that some people are worried that all this influx of, you know, shredded steel is going to depress the price of steel?
Well, honestly, the price of steel is highest it's been in I don't even know how long, right now.
So that may not be a bad thing.
Yes.
Al, thank you so much.
Oh, no problem.
Al Schoenfeld, yard manager at Broken Wheel Auto Parts and Wrecking in Cleveland, Ohio, with his view of the Cash for Clunkers program. We'll be back in 30 seconds with a look at salary versus fee-based pay for doctors, here and now. Question, if you're insured and you knew your doctor was paid each time he performed a procedure, would you turn down a procedure if you thought you might not need it? Or would you say, what the heck, it's covered, he's getting paid? Most doctors in America are paid through fees, but some get a fixed annual salary, regardless of how many tests they perform. It's not a new concept, especially for academic hospitals like Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, which has been doing it since the early 1900s. In fact, back in 1910, a landmark report argued for teaching hospitals to be staffed only with salaried doctors. Dr. Edward Miller is CEO of Johns Hopkins Medicine and Dean of the University School of Medicine. Doctor, obviously a fan of salary-based pay. Is the fear of fee-based pay that doctors might perform unnecessary treatments because the attitude is, as we said, it's covered and nobody gets hurt, so what's the harm?
Well, I think that's why the cost of health care continues to rise, because it is fee-based. It's not based on trying to have a healthier patient or try to put preventive measures in place to make the population better.
Now, but isn't this thinking more widespread than perhaps with the doctors who might use the fee as an incentive to do testing? We asked that question at the beginning of the segment, and here's an interesting poll. It was conducted by the Kaiser Foundation, NPR, and Harvard School of Public Health. And they found that 70% of patients prefer a fee-based service model. Only 25% said that doctors should get a yearly fixed salary. And I'm wondering, does that have something to do with the thinking that when it comes right down to your own health, your thinking might be, you know what, I'm covered, let him do all the tests he wants, insurance is going to pay for it?
Well, that's one of the problems in the system. The people have to have some skin in the game, I think. More and more people are starting to understand that they are controlling part of the cost of this system. And as they see their premiums go up and the copays go up, they're going to understand that somehow we got to get this cost under control. And one of the ways is for people to understand what services they're really getting. And the second is, how do I stay healthier?
What? How do you get doctors on board the idea of moving from fee-based to salaries? The New York Times writes about a Dr. Turner Stauffer, who left a small hospital in upstate New York that uses the salary model because he very frankly said he had to make more money for his kids in college.
Well, that's probably one end of the spectrum. We're certainly seeing more and more physicians that want to have a fixed income. They know the dollars that are coming in. And as a matter of fact, as you're starting to see, the next generation of physicians are much more used to a salary approach. The group that's coming in now has very different expectations. And there are other advantages of working in an academic healthcare center. You can advance medicine. I mean, that's what a lot of people want to do, is make a difference in people's lives. And one of the places you can do it is an academic healthcare center.
But what if you don't work in an academic healthcare center? There are fewer and fewer doctors working in private practice, but they don't have that same incentive that a teaching hospital would bring.
Well, I think that's part of the change that has to occur in this whole issue of reforming healthcare. One of the things that we could do is to help them get an electronic patient record into their office. Most of the people in private practice still are putting things down on a piece of paper. They have no way to have a database, no way to really follow in a long term the effects of their care on their patients. Most academic healthcare centers have electronic patient records, and it's much easier to care once you've gone through that installation process. There is money in the healthcare stimulus package, actually, to make that happen, but we need to move forward on that.
Well, in fact, this is part of a broader idea that you and others have of how academic medical centers like Johns Hopkins can bring innovation across the country. The Association of American Medical Colleges has proposed something called healthcare innovation zones, with academic facilities leading the way. Tell us more about that.
So the innovation zones are a way for the academic healthcare center actually to partner with others, so that we have the ability to take care of a population of individuals. Hopkins, for many years, has cared for really three major populations. Priority Partners, which is a managed care HMO, essentially for Medicaid patients. We have U.S. Family Health Plan, and we have our own health insurance plan here at Hopkins. So we have almost 200,000 people that are in these plans, and we manage all of their care. A premium is paid per month per member, and then we pay physicians, we pay hospitals, we pay home care, we pay for our primary care network. We take care of everything we can for those patients. And we actually have been able to show that we can make a small profit, because you need to make a small profit. And you could do this in different parts of the country. What happens in Baltimore probably is not going to be the same thing that's going to happen in San Diego or San Francisco. But each region could figure out what are the best partnerships and be able to deliver care to a significant number of the population.
Well, and again, back to the smaller practices and back to the idea of salary versus fee-based.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a small general practice, you're going to have to send someone maybe towns away for, let's say, radiation treatment. It feels as if there's a part of the population that's going to have to be fee-based.
Correct. You're not going to get rid of fee-for-service. That will never go away. But there's no reason that you can't have the two systems side by side. And one system may prove better in an urban setting, and maybe fee-for-service works better in a rural setting. But again, the innovation zone plan that Congress has or could propose would be one way to test that model.
Dr. Edward Miller, CEO of Johns Hopkins Medicine and Dean of the University School of Medicine, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Well, let's take a second now for a clarification. We had a segment last week on the language of the healthcare debate. Catherine Manning of Lynchburg, Virginia wrote, "Did conservative columnist Cal Thomas just say you can get counseling about end-of-life issues from your doctor, your spouse, or your minister? You don't need a government bureaucrat to do that." Anna Benvo of Massachusetts added, "He should be told unequivocally that that is not in any of the proposed legislation, period." And here's Kathy McMullen of Birmingham, Alabama. "The actual proposal would reimburse physicians for the time they spend discussing end-of-life care with Medicare patients." You are all right. Here for clarification is a portion of an earlier interview we did with Noam Levy of the Los Angeles Times. He underscored there is no government bureaucrat, no death panel in the proposed House bill.
There is no death panel. There is a provision in the bill which would reimburse doctors for providing a consultation with senior citizens on Medicare. It's optional. The senior citizens are not required to have this consultation if they don't want to talk about their options, such things as a living will.
A lot of people have doctors who will take the time to do this, but many won't because they haven't been reimbursed for it. So this is to make sure the doctors get paid for this time.
That's right. And the idea would be that, well, if Medicare provides some incentive by paying doctors to do this, that maybe there would be more of these kinds of discussions which could be productive in the long run. I should note the AARP supports this, as does the American Medical Association.
Again, no government bureaucrat in the proposed health care reform counseling end-of-life issues. We'll be back in 1 minute, here and now. Even before the current economic crisis, the record industry was in dire straits, what with alternatives like digital sharing and networking sites. And now a patronage model is making a comeback. There was a time when musicians found wealthy patrons to support their work, superfans who essentially paid artists to feed the muse. Well, artists are doing that again, not with super-rich fans, but with everyday ones. Producer Christopher Blagg looks at the emerging trend of fan-funded music.
For several years, the trend of artists going directly to their fans to help fund their projects has been gaining steam, with the likes of Jill Sobule, Mika Polly, and Josh Fries leading the way. In return, fans get what they covet most from their favorite artists: access. Boston-based musician Jake Brennan has taken the next step. He recently started the Hector Fund, a web-based company that conducts artist funding campaigns on behalf of independent musicians.
I figured if you could have a blog, an online destination that was basically generally about music, had a very slick e-commerce system tied to it where fans could come and find out about whatever they wanted to listen to and their favorite bands, and then see and then fund their bands in exchange for exclusive access and perks and basically things that you can't buy at Walmart or Best Buy.
Right now, the Hector Fund has fundraising campaigns underway for British folk legend Linda Thompson, dub reggae superstars John Brown's Body, Afro-Latin singer Alex Alviar, and Brennan's own band, the hedonistic electro-punk outfit Bodega Girls. Depending on your level of support, fan perks could include an autographed CD or a song written specifically for you. For a few dollars more, you could sing backup on a track, or even get a yoga lesson conducted by the band. The Bodega Girls offer some of the most creative perks in their campaign, including the Burt Bacharach special.
Okay, the Burt Bacharach level is you get a date and we come there and we're your mariachi band, we're your Elvis Costello to Burt Bacharach, and we'll do whatever you want. We'll cook for you, we'll serenade you and your date, we'll basically serve you drinks, do whatever you want.
I met up with Brennan in a Boston suburb, where the Bodega Girls were fulfilling a $500 Ain't Nothing But a House Party request for a high school graduate's celebration.
All right, I'm going to keep you going right now. I need your help with this one. Meet everyone who will be after me.
As the party was winding down and the band mingled with the star-struck kids, I asked graduating senior Brett Weiner what it was like having the Bodega Girls in his backyard.
Everything I hope for and more, actually.
Is it?
Yeah, they're awesome. They're a great group of guys. You can talk to them, they can have a beer with you. Awesome, yeah.
Sort of reminds me of those American Express commercials. Hiring the Bodega Girls to play at your graduation party, $500. Drinking beer with the band afterwards, priceless. Actually, the Bodega Girls could have gone the traditional record label route. Instead of playing high school graduation parties or cooking intimate meals for their fans. But when they thought about it, that route just didn't make sense in the current climate of the music industry.
You know, I've been approached by labels in the last 2 years who have basically said to me, all right, go record your record, pay for it, come to me, have a developed fan base of, you know, 500 people in each city, and then we'll talk about working with you. And it's like, well, why, if I can do that, why would I work with you? You know, for what? So you can take a cut of my money for doing nothing? I just did all the work, you know?
Other musicians have come up with equally creative ways to feed their artistry and escape the grip of the mainstream music industry. Take songwriter Aaron McEwen.
Things we do and the things we let between the tide and the cigarettes. All the cups we cannot sip between our legs across our lips. Don't go.
Her marketing strategies have run the gamut from selling homemade tapes out of the back of her car to having her records hawked by a major label. But when it came time to do a new record, she wanted her independence back.
When you take someone else's money, you're on their schedule. It's no crime, that's just the deal. If you take someone's money, you owe them something. And I didn't want to take anyone's money. I didn't want to be on anyone's schedule, and I didn't want to owe them anything creatively.
So McEwen went about crafting the exact album she wanted to make. It took her a long time and a lot of money. To put her record out, she needed to bring that debt down. Looking around at her peers, she was intrigued by this emerging fan-funded model.
I wanted to join in that, but I felt really uncomfortable just simply asking my fans for money. And I think most artists do. I think We'd like to have it more like a barter system, actually. I give you some music, you give me something else.
That something else turned out to be an innovative, tech-savvy approach to artist funding.
I'm Aaron, and this is my house, and now you're in it thanks to the magic of the intranet. Okay, that's Emily, my manager, who's chatting with you guys right now.
She put on a series of intimate performances she dubbed Cabin Fever to raise the money. The twist being these were web-based house concerts. For $10, fans were invited into a streaming concert live from McEwen's own home.
It's a secret space. It's where I do most of my music writing.
Fans got to interact with McEwen via a chat window, requesting songs and commenting on the performance.
People are really excited to have a hand in music. It feels more like a community that way. I think the major label business for me always felt like the wizard behind the curtain. You know, it's got this like smoke and mirrors mystery of, oh my God, how did Rihanna get that way? Or what, Beyonce, she looks so amazing. What's she like in real life? But that's all managed by a company.
So what's harm and ruin and remind us of who we were in the darker time?
In an ironic twist, McEwen's Cabin Fever artist funding project has landed her another record contract. This time, though, the recording is already done, and it's all on her terms. Hundreds of Lions will be coming out this October on Righteous Babe Records. But just because McEwen is now in a favorable record deal doesn't mean her unique bartering system with her fans is going to end. She says there'll be plenty more web concerts in her future.
It's been met with such wonderful response from fans, from fellow musicians, from people like yourself, in the media, that I feel like, and it feels so right to me, it feels like I really have found something that fulfills all of my creative impulses. I will definitely do something more with it.
That's singer-songwriter Aaron McEwen. Our story on fan funding was produced by Christopher Blagg. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Well, before we go, a goodbye to Gospel Hall of Fame singer Marie Knight, who died this past Sunday. She began singing as a child in her Pentecostal church, and as she told us in 2007, it was there that gospel legend Sister Rosetta Tharpe heard Marie and invited her on tour. Their call and response songs were hits in the 1940s.
Up above my head.
Up above my head.
I hear music in the air.
I hear music in the air.
Now up above my head.
Up above my head.
Eventually, Marie Knight pretty much retired. She worked at the phone company, became a minister in Harlem. But in 2003, she sang on a tribute album to Sister Rosetta Tharpe, and in 2007 released her own CD, Let Us Get Together, a tribute to Reverend Gary Davis.
Let us get together right down here. Let us get together right down here.
Marie Knight died this past Sunday at the age of 89. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great and safe Labor Day weekend. We'll be here for you Monday. Please join us here and now.
Walk together right down. Let us walk together right down here. Let us walk together right down here. Let us do our living right down here. Let us do our living right down here. Let us do our living.